Our topic tonight is to reflect together on a sensitive issue. And our goal is to give some context and then an opportunity for a conversation. But the first chunk of our evening is going to be spent on some background and some understanding on a concept, a Hebrew word, which is multi-layered, and we'll unpack together just in a few minutes. And that is the concept of halacha. And we're going to do this in thinking about, in the background, all the amazing, extraordinary work that the Ark does in serving the Chicagoland Jewish community. With this word, halacha, which is a Hebrew term that means, it literally means a path, a way of going, we're going to think about how this halacha, this way of going, the way of doing, the way of being, affects things that occur under the auspices of the Ark in a lot of different ways. So first, to understand why the Ark has something to do with halacha, we need to figure out what is halacha. What is this way, this path? One way to translate it is Jewish law or a path, a set of guidelines, practices. So we got to go all the way back to the beginning of this story. And that is, if you were standing at Mount Sinai with Moses, what did you get? What did God hand you? What did you receive? Because a lot of the questions that we're dealing with today, they didn't have, you know, meat that was created from cultured cells in a plastic dish, and whether or not that's like fleishig or parif, right? They didn't have IVF with ICSI, where you're choosing the gender of an embryo. Like, they didn't have those things in those days. So what did you get? So the answer is, you got two things. And this is really where everything begins. And this is what we need to understand to have an intelligent conversation about halacha and how it relates to our lives. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, got two things. He got a text, a written text. That's what we call the Torah Shebichsav. Torah, writing in Hebrew, the Torah, which literally means a guide, that is bichsav, written. So that was a collection of narratives, stories, and little bits of text, which sound like laws, but they're very terse. If you've ever opened up the five books of Moses, there's not a lot of meat on those bones. It's bare bones, skeletal. In addition to that, he got another Torah. We actually got two. We got one, that's a Torah that was written, and then he got a Torah, which is the oral tradition, which is referred in Hebrew as the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition. How you take this text, this limited text that only has about 300-some thousand letters, and apply it in every situation today. So what, if, and by the way, if you ask the average school child, they will not necessarily know to tell you, for, you know, to explicate this, but Maimonides, we're going to give you, last time we talked about Maimonides, we're going to give you the Maimonides cliff notes to the entirety of Jewish law right now. Maimonides says it's very simple. There are five things that Moses got. He was authorized to interpret what it says in the book, because the book is very limited. That's it. It's a box. There's nothing added. There's nothing taken away. That's all there is. So Maimonides said there were five elements of this oral tradition. The first are what we call pirushim hamakubalim, explanations. So here's an example. Pardon the handwriting. What do we take on the holiday of Sukkot? What do we take in our hands, for many of us? What's that? Lulav and etrog, right? How do you know that? It actually does not say anywhere in the Bible the word esrog. It doesn't. It says pre-Eitz Hadar, right? It says a beautiful fruit. How do you know what that is? The answer is, that was an explanation that was given to Maimonides, to Moses, and explained by Maimonides. It's an explanation. What it says, this is what it means. No one in the history of mankind ever thought that the words pre-Eitz Hadar meant anything other than? That's it. Great. That's explanation. Then there are things which it doesn't say anything about them in the text, but we have specific traditions about them. So, how tall does your sukkah have to be? We're picking on sukkahs right now. How tall does your sukkah have to be? How much matzah do you have to eat? How large does the mikveh have to be? I don't know. It doesn't say it anywhere. You can flip to, you trust me on this one just for the moment. It doesn't say it anywhere in the text at all. So how do you know? The answer is, it's a tradition. That's what we call halacha l'moshe m'Sinai. That's a tradition. Then Moses was authorized to do two more things. One are called takanos, decrees. So he said, look, the rabbis, they're going to come along and find opportunities to connect you with godliness. You have a license to do that. So for example, Friday afternoon, right before sundown, some people in this room probably fulfill one of the traditional rabbinic decrees. What is that? Before the onset of Shabbos? That's right. It does not say anywhere in the written Torah to light candles on Friday before Shabbos. Doesn't say it. But the rabbis introduced that. That's part of the oral tradition that the rabbis added to what it says. Similarly, they added restrictions. So, for example, the rabbis said, wait a second. You know, one of the 39 categories of things that we don't do on Shabbos, according to the traditional halacha, is carrying. Well, they said, carrying, that's only from a public domain to a private domain. Well, the rabbi said, if you're going to carry to a public domain, that's going to be a biblical violation. I think it's a bad idea to carry it to your neighbor's house. Because maybe you're going to carry it to your neighbor's house, and then the next day, the next Shabbos, you're going to carry it out to the street. And they made all kinds of restrictions and safeguards. That's the fourth area. And then the last area are what we're going to call the tools. Because until now, I mean, how many arguments can you possibly have around the first four sections? The first one, there are no arguments. The second one, there are very few arguments. Third and fourth, how many rules did the rabbis make in addition? This is where everything happens. It's in the section of tools. Moses was given a set of intellectual tools. And those tools are what we use over centuries to interpret the text. So, for example, if I were to ask you, what is this line of logic? If the ark served 1,000 clients last year and it had a budget of $1 million, this year the ark is going to serve 2,000 clients. So how much do you think the budget is going to be? Is it going to be $1 million or is it going to be more than $1 million? What do you think?
Depends how much Adam raises.
Okay, good. Right? What's the budget going to be? Is it going to be the same million?
I don't know.
It's going to be more. How do you know that? What's that? That's right. Explain what that is, Josh.
If you can only do a million with this much, then if you're going to do more than... if you 1,000, you need a million. If you do more than 1,000, then you definitely need more than a million.
Exactly.
Certainly not.
It's a logical inference. One other, you know, these are all tools. But now, once you start getting into analyzing, the rabbis over centuries, they used the tools, but they didn't always see the same thing. So if I were to ask you, is this can and that can, are they the same can? What would you say?
No.
Why not?
They're instantiations of a can. They're unique.
In what way are they unique?
This one, that one's that one.
Well,
similar.
It's a very non-Talmudic analysis right there, Larry. No disrespect. But let's get serious here. Here we have, if I were to ask you, somebody goes to the supermarket, I'm not pointing fingers. Somebody goes to the supermarket and they were told to get, what do I have here? LaCroix Raz Cranberry. This is good. Raz Cranberry. So then they come home, instead of Raz Cranberry, they have lime LaCroix. So the other person in their house says, I told you to get this. They say, what's the difference? Seltzer is seltzer. It's the same can. So one person might look at these cans and say, these are exactly the same. It's overpriced bubbly water. Right? It's the same thing. It's a piece of metal where they put carbonated water inside. It's the same thing and a couple of flavors. And somebody else will look at these cans and say, they're totally dissimilar. One is pink and one is green. I have one child who's colorblind. He would probably not really, I mean, on some level he could distinguish between the two, but not easily. So now you can understand why in the fifth area, when you have to interpret, the rabbis had different tools, and those tools are going to be used differently. So this set of tools was passed down all the way from Moses at Sinai through many generations, and all of these generations, rabbis are using these tools until the end of the period of the Talmud to analyze what it says in the Chumash. So it says in the Chumash, for example, do not cook. Lo sivashel, do not cook gedi, a calf, bachalev imo, in its mother's milk. That's just what it says on the books. But the rabbis got into the between the lines, underneath the lines, above the lines, interpreting, comparing. How many times does it say it? Why does it say it like that? I'll give you one more example, and then I'm going to try to bring this home a little bit more. This is another way of understanding. We're about to put on our Talmudic analytical thinking caps, because this is important to understand if you want to understand the development of halacha. How is it that there are so many arguments? How is it that there are so many different perspectives on the same issue? So here we go. I'm sorry you can't see this yet, Adam. Okay, Marna, could you read that for us, please?
I didn't say I ate your lunch.
Okay. You ready? Can I call on some people? But I don't remember the names, and this time we don't have the card, so I'm at a serious disadvantage. So I'm just going to ask you to just introduce yourself again, because I don't remember from last time. So who wants to just jump in for a second? Yes, your name?
I didn't say I ate your lunch.
Okay. So one second. So you're saying, I didn't say I ate your lunch. You know what I did? I just ate it. I didn't say I ate your lunch. I ate your lunch. In the back on the right, what's your name, ma'am?
Me?
Yeah.
Radha.
Radha. How else might you read this sentence? Where would you put the emphasis if you were reading this sentence?
I.
Oh. I didn't say I ate your lunch, but you said I ate the lunch, right? How else might you punctuate this sentence? I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Go ahead.
Amy,
where else might you punctuate this sentence? Where, if you were analyzing, you are now a Talmudic rabbi 2,500 years ago looking at this text thinking, how else can I parse this? You do this every year at your Seder. This is like the boring zip-through part of the Seder. This is what the rabbis are doing. How would you? How else? What else might you?
I was going to say, so I ate. I didn't say I ate your lunch.
I didn't say I ate your lunch. I said I took your lunch. I didn't say I ate it. Where else might you punctuate this? What's your name?
Wendy.
I
didn't say your lunch.
Ah, I didn't say I ate your lunch. I said I ate my lunch. What do you want from me? Where else might you go with this? One second. Where else might you go with this?
Lunch.
Yeah. I didn't say your lunch. I ate your dinner. Right? You could do this on and on. The rabbis are taking their tools and they're looking very carefully because this is a divine document. The Torah is given by God. So whenever you have a verse, they're doing this. That's what's happening. They're constantly assessing what is the inflection point in that document. And this is going to go on for generations. It's going to carry us till today. So I'm going to be very presumptuous for a moment, and I apologize for the arrogance, but let's say Steve Blonder, let's see, number one on the list here, B. Stan Diskin, where's Stan? Here we go. Sharon Berman, we're going to go with B. Come on down. You're going to look at this document and you're going to see on the left-hand side in the italics names, you're going to get all the way from Moses, from Sinai, down to the prophets. That's going to take you to the bold names on the left, which is going to be Second Temple period, 120 sages. That's going to take you to the end of the bold section all the way to the 3rd century of the Common Era. You're going all the way from Sinai into Israel, getting expelled from Israel, back to Israel. We're hitting the period of the Talmud in the sans serif font, Rav Shmuel, Rabbi Yochanan. That's going to take you down to the 5th through the 10th century, which is mostly anonymous sages, which is why there are no names, we just cut it down for ease. That will take you all the way through the last 1,000 years. This is a chart, an uninterrupted chart of tradition of rabbis to students in a study hall that will take you down to Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who passed away. He dies in 1993 on the bottom right. And he had many, many students. He had three students who were very influential people in my life and my development. The first is my teacher, Rav Herschel Schachter, Shalita, that stands for You Should Live and Be Well. He lives in New York. He was a longtime teacher of mine. He's one of the most erudite and well-known rabbinic personalities of the day, as well as Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz of blessed memory, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the longtime Av Bezdin of the head of the rabbinical court in Chicago for over 20-some years. And then Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein of blessed memory, first in Yeshiva University, then in Har Etzion in Israel. And I was a student of the three of them. And so, just to be presumptuous, at least for tonight, you can consider yourself, you know, I'm not sure that this is a blessing or something else, but this is the whole story of halacha. That's it. That's it. Now you got to find who you're going to pass it to. But the point is that the background of this whole story is to understand that this is where it started when there was an experience where all Jews stood at a mountain. They got two things. They got a written text. They got five pieces of a puzzle of the oral tradition. And that was passed on in this uninterrupted tradition all the way until today. Now, after the Talmudic period, the rabbis stop using tools. They don't have the same authority. Now we only interpret what the previous generations have set down. But the idea is now you can understand why there are so many different perspectives. But one more caveat, and then I'll be open to taking questions before two more comments. On the other side of your sheet is a summary. This I got from Chabad.org. It was just a quick, easy way of taking this in English, of Maimonides' 13 principles of faith. And this is the underpinning, this is the working assumption that I have when I come into this room so that my bias is on the table. The first section of statements of this understanding of Judaism has to do with creation, that there is a God, there is a force who is attentive to the world, paying attention, involved, giving us opportunities. The second chunk, you see I put a pause, is that there is something called revelation. So there's creation, there's revelation, that God somehow took his endless energy, endless light, and transformed it into a message for humankind that was revealed at Sinai, and that is the eternal blueprint of our way, of our halakha. And the last chunk is redemption, or resurrection, and the ultimate fixing of the world, the mending of a broken world in which we live. So there are three sections. There's creation, revelation, and then redemption or resurrection, however you're going to call it. But these are the assumptions as to why I look at the Torah as a living divine document with a human partnership. You see on the bottom, these tools, they're divine tools, but they're human engagements. So different rabbis over the generations argued about these. They applied them differently. This is the background to understanding halacha.
Rice for
Passover. Excellent question. Why do things change?
Who's right and who's wrong?
Ah, this is it. Great. Who's right and who's wrong? First of all, when did this whole issue about argument begin? Because at some point, when Moses got down from Sinai, I mean, who was arguing? So that the Talmud discusses in Tractate Sanhedrin that if you look on your sheets, there is a pair of students on the left side, about 40 before the Common Era, Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai, some of you may have heard of these figures. Hillel was a famous rabbinic personality who came from Babylonia, from Iraq to Israel. They only argued about five or six things. But their students, they, according to the Talmud, their students did not pay attention carefully enough to their methodologies, and they diverged greatly. Now, how could it be that they diverged? The answer is the same way that we interpreted this sentence, I didn't say I ate your lunch differently. These students started to interpret these verses differently. Now, can you say with certainty, I mean, this is a plain and simple sentence, there's no special quality, there's nothing divine. But if there's a divine document, there's a tradition that there are 70 different ways of interpreting it. So can you say that definitively one is right and one is wrong? It could be that there are different elements. Is it absolutely correct to say that these cans are similar? Yeah. Is it also absolutely correct to say these cans are dissimilar? Yeah. So that's how you can have machlokas, which means argument. So now, as the generations move forward, we keep trying to parse out, okay, how do you define this can? What are the elements? What makes it similar? What makes it different? And how do the circumstances play in? So you may have a rule, which is the same rule. In many respects, the Torah never changed. You know what's amazing? I don't know how many words there are in the Torah. There are tens of thousands of words. There are over 300,000 letters. If you look in every Torah school in the entire world, from this entire tradition, there are only 11 or 12 or 13 discrepancies in any Sefer Torah. And of those, 9 or 11 of them are vavs, which already in the Talmudic times there was a question about. There's one or two words that have a hey or an aleph. That's it. That's all the discrepancies there are over 300,000 letters. So in certain ways, the document didn't change and the principles didn't change, but the application changes. Because you have multiple ways of viewing something, it could be that in one circumstance, we're going to rule one way, and in a different circumstance, we're going to use a different. So we're going to use the same tools, we're going to use our tools, but we're going to apply them differently. So let's say you have a case, I don't know, let's say you have a dish. For many of us in this room, thank God, we are blessed that if we need to make Passover, we can buy a brand new dish. Thank God. But there are people who are not in that situation. And if you tell them they have to buy a new dish for Passover, they're thinking to themselves, where am I going to get that dish? Who's going to pay for that? How am I going to afford that? So the rabbis will look at the same questioner. So you might call the rabbi before Passover and say, look, I have this glass pitcher and I use it for such and such. And the rabbi will say, you should buy a new glass pitcher for Passover. And then the ark might call the rabbi and say, we have a client who has a glass pitcher. And the rabbi will say, for that ark client, let them wash it with cold water and soap, and they can use it on Passover. Ah, it's the same question. The answer is, if you're using the tools to apply these principles, you'll apply them differently in different circumstances. So that's why you can have two people who are going to ask the same rabbi the same question, they're going to get a different answer. And maybe the answer that was applied using these tools in the 18th century is going to be different in the 21st century. So these principles, on the one hand, are eternal. They never change. On the other hand, they're always changing because they're always applied differently in different circumstances. So now, two more points and then something for us to talk about. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who's pictured here on the bottom right, he has an essay, which I didn't give you because it's late tonight, where he talks about how emotions cannot be the arbiter of practice. Why do you think that would be?
Because then you apply the same tools to get different results.
And then are you really even applying the same tools? Because, right?
It's an end justifies the means.
So Rabbi Soloveitchik uses this to paint a picture of the story of Korach, the rebellious elder in the desert, who came to the people with an emotional appeal about a legal question. And Moses said, that's not how legal questions are decided. It's not based on how you feel. It's based on the series of tools and principles that we have handed down. Within that, there are many opportunities to apply and employ different strategies. But Rabbi Soloveitchik describes at length that we have to distinguish between laws, principles, and feelings. Obviously, our feelings affect, you know, how we relate to and experience the laws, and the laws relate to how a person feels. If a person is going to be emotionally affected by a particular case, so then that needs to be taken into consideration from a law standpoint. Rabbi Schwartz, of blessed memory, he would emphasize this point often. I had the amazing, distinct privilege the last few years of his life, when he was still publicly active, I mustered up the courage to ask Rabbi Schwartz if I could come. I mean, at that time he was over 80, and he was answering questions from rabbis all over the world, and he was right here in Chicago on Howard in his office. And I said to him, I said, would you mind if you just share a few minutes of your time with me? So every Wednesday I would go during my lunch break. He would keep a legal yellow pad with the questions that rabbis from around the country and around the world sent him. And he would review them with me and tell me, and this is what we call in halachic language, shimush, like really understanding what real life is about in rabbinics and in rulings. And it's like apprenticeship, so to speak. And he would review how he answered the different questions. And some of these questions were exceedingly, exceedingly difficult. Because if the rabbi didn't know the answer in his neighborhood, in his community somewhere, they called Rabbi Schwartz in Chicago, right here on Howard. And he would talk about these things. And one of the things that he emphasized was how when someone is affected emotionally by a certain situation, there was a case, there were a lot of difficult cases. There was a case of a woman who turns out that her husband was, unbeknownst to her, a drug dealer and was involved in all kinds of difficult. So this was a very serious halachic question, but it affected the emotional state of this person, this human being, this woman. It was her whole emotional makeup. And so he, on the one hand, took people's psychological and emotional experiences into the considerations, but that's not what determines the law. The law is determined by the process. That's number one. Number two is that once we have this law, and it's, so to speak, fixed, it's this, so to speak, dispassionate set of rules, it creates parity. Parity. There's no special treatment. There are different circumstances, and every circumstance is going to be different. But it's not, you know, rabbis, we just work here. You know what I'm saying? We just try to understand what the law is and how to apply it to a particular situation. We don't have any latitude or authority to change rules, you know, make up rules. Like, that's not part of our purview. So everybody under the sun is subject to the same rules. And that makes it an even playing field for everyone. It doesn't matter how many connections you have. It doesn't matter whether you're a legacy family. Like, there are no shortcuts. There are no shortcuts. If we're committed to this system, everybody is bought in. So now, when we bring it back to the Ark, once we understand that there is a system, and that system is in place based on generations, and those generations come all the way back to Sinai, where we were given principles and values, so we can understand why that actually, even though sometimes it's difficult to navigate the details, but that is so important for an institution like the Ark, which is serving such a diverse clientele, that nobody on the front lines or nobody in any boardroom or anywhere else has the responsibility of owning that decision themselves, and that it shouldn't have to change from one generation to the next generation. This is a set standard that we just need to apply differently in every circumstance, in every generation. So yes, sometimes it's challenging to navigate the complexities of the modern world, given the limitations and the strictures that every legal code by definition has, but that's part of what actually makes it helpful. That it gives us a framework. And then within that framework, we figure out how do we operate. So I come from a Sabbath observant home. We're going away. This past week was my father-in-law's 70th birthday. So my wife, Nechama, all of her siblings, we all met at this house in Orlando. And we had two houses, 8-9-bedroom houses. We have, thank God, almost, it's a very large group. So how do you observe Shabbos and kosher in a random house? So you go through your checklist and you figure out, and that structure of Shabbos gave us a beautiful present moment. Some people view the restrictions of Shabbos as like, oh, I can't take this, it's horrible. It's a list of restrictions and I'm chained down and it's miserable. But if you choose to subscribe to those values and those principles, so you figure out what lights you need to turn on before and what crock pot you need to put on before and what sink you have to kosherize after 24 hours with the boiling water and the microwave, and all of a sudden you have a beautiful experience with your family together. So a lot of this issue of how we navigate halacha is an attitudinal one. If we understand and appreciate this is a time-honored system that has stood there for the Jewish community for literally thousands of years, applied differently over the generations, but this is a system. It's a system that sometimes is difficult, but helps us realize the priorities, the values that we want to see, that we hold dear, then we realize that it's a gift. I'll give you one last example, and then I want to hand something out for us to talk about. Sometimes observing halacha is stressful. Usually that comes because there's a conflict of values. And what we usually do when we have that kind of conflict is we get like caught up in the minutia of the struggle. As opposed to, especially in a space like this, can we take a step back and realize that that conflict is actually an opportunity for us to reflect on different values and thinking about how do we navigate these different values and what do we need to do to accommodate them? Somebody has a close relative that's hospitalized on Shabbos. So if it's a potential life or threat or death threatening situation, of course, you do everything. Every rabbi in the world who knows anything will tell you if it's even a slight chance of loss of human life, you do anything, everything on Shabbos to save that life. But let's say it's someone, a relative, who's taken care of by doctors, and they don't need me to be there. So sometimes it is hard not to just jump in the car and travel to that person on Shabbos. You want to be with them. You want to encourage them. You feel like you want to do something. But what also means is that we need to take a step back and say, oh, there are actually two values at play here. There's the value of Bikur Cholim, of visiting that person who's sick, and then there's the value of the sanctity of this moment, of this time. And so we actually need to then dig in and figure out what's the priority and how do you make that decision. So these things are going to come up all the time in an organizational context. So it's about sitting down and figuring out, okay, let's run through the process and let's figure out what are the issues here and what does this halacha, this path, have to say about these issues. The halacha is like a guardrail. It's like the median on the highway. You don't live to worry about the median and the guardrail. You live to be on the journey. That is the path of life that we are each tasked with of bringing godliness into the world. Each one of us has a job to bring godliness into the world. We're on the path that Hashem put us here for. That's our path. The halacha is there to keep us from falling into a ditch in this way and that way. So it's very helpful. It's not meant to obsessive overtake what we're doing. The ark, every one of us personally, every important institution, we have a path. We have a mission. The halacha helps us maintain those boundaries as we go through the journey in dealing with the issues that come up as we go along. So I'll take questions, comments, or observations briefly, and then I want to hand out something for us to read together before we close up.